From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Last night was unlike anything I have seen in my adult life in Mississippi. I hope I never see it again. For every member of this police department, it was unlike anything that they had seen in their career. For every member of the fire department, it was unlike anything they had seen in their entire career.
Protests are continuing in Milwaukee 2 days after police shot dead a 23-year-old African-American man named Sylville Smith. On Saturday night, local residents set fire to police cars and several local businesses, including a gas station. 17 people were arrested. 4 police officers were reportedly injured. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has called in the National Guard. We'll go to Milwaukee to speak with the poet and community activist Muhib Dyer, then to the Olympic Games in Rio.
I mean, this medal is not just for me. It's for a whole bunch of people who have came before me and have been inspiration to me. Maritza Cullen, and it's for all the people after me who believe they can't do it. And I just want to be inspiration to others that you can do it.
It's been an historic week in Rio, as Simone Manuel has become the first African-American to win a gold medal in an individual swim event, and the pioneering African-American gymnast Simone Biles has just won her 3rd gold. We'll speak with sports writer Jesse Washington and the gold medal-winning swimmer Anthony Irvin, who just became the oldest individual Olympic swimming gold medalist. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests are continuing in Milwaukee 2 days after police shot dead a 23-year-old African-American man named Sylville Smith. On Sunday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker activated the National Guard after local residents set fire to police cars and several local businesses, including a gas station Saturday night. 17 people were arrested. 4 police officers were reportedly injured. Last night, 2 police officers were reportedly injured, and 1 person was hospitalized after being shot by an unknown assailant. This is a man who said he's the brother of Sylville Smith, speaking about the uprising.
Right now, you got a city riot going on because, once again, the police has failed to protect us like they say they was going to do. They failed to be here for the people like they say they like they sworn in to do, you know? And us as a community, we're not going to protect ourselves. But if we don't have anyone to protect us, then this is what you get. You know, you get riots. You got people out here going crazy. We losing loved ones every day to the people that sworn in to protect us.
The Milwaukee Police Department is defending its use of force in the case of Sylville Smith. Police say he was shot while trying to flee from an officer who had stopped his car. Police Chief Edward Flynn said he'd viewed video from the officer's body camera, and it showed Smith had turned toward him with a gun in his hand after the traffic stop. Many local residents said the tension between their community and the police has been rising for years. Milwaukee is considered to be one of the most segregated cities in the country. Meanwhile, in Baltimore, 12 people were arrested in a protest at the opening of Maryland's Fraternal Order of Police conference Sunday afternoon. Members of the group Baltimore Block locked themselves together using PVC pipes and chained themselves to a railing to block the escalator leading to the conference at the Hyatt. It's the latest in a series of protests in recent weeks against police unions, which activists say defend officers accused of brutality. In news from the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton released her latest tax returns on Friday, showing she and her husband, President Bill Clinton, earned $10.6 million in 2015. More than half the income came from speeches. They paid an effective tax rate of 35%. Between 2007 and 2015, the Clintons have made $150 million. Clinton's running mate, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, also released his returns Friday. He and his wife made $313,000 in 2015. This comes as Donald Trump continues to refuse to release his tax returns, citing an audit. A series of tax experts quoted in a recent New York Times piece headlined $0 say it's possible Trump pays no income taxes at all, given the vast array of tax loopholes available to real estate developers. Trump's running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, suggested in an interview Saturday that Pence himself may soon release his own returns in what would be the latest point of disagreement between the two men. Meanwhile, divisions are widening between the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Politico is reporting Republican Party leaders are privately talking about cutting off financial support to Trump by October, if not earlier. In an editorial published this week, the Wall Street Journal calls on the Republican Party to write off the nominee if he doesn't change his behavior by Labor Day, which is less than 3 weeks away. A number of his associates who spoke to the New York Times have painted Trump as being exhausted, bewildered, sullen, and erratic. Trump has blasted the Times article, calling the New York Times a failing newspaper of fiction, although Trump has reportedly not asked for any retractions. A recent Reuters poll shows nearly one-fifth of registered Republicans want Trump to drop out of the race. In public, however, the Republican Party is continuing attempts to project unity. On Friday, Republican National Committee Chair Rentz Priebus made a surprise appearance at a Trump rally in Erie, Pennsylvania, where he introduced and hugged Donald Trump. At this rally, Trump attempted to walk back his recent comments calling President Obama the founder of ISIS. Instead, Trump said his comments had been sarcastic, quote, but not that sarcastic, unquote. This comes as Trump is slated to release his proposals for fighting ISIS during a speech in Ohio today. He's also expected to further explain his plans to significantly limit immigration, which at times have included calls for a complete ban on all Muslims. His campaign is now also suggesting a test intended to vet immigrants' views on issues such as women's and gay rights. Meanwhile, the New York Times has revealed new details about Trump's campaign manager Paul Manafort's political consulting work in Ukraine. The Times reports that handwritten ledgers unearthed by Ukraine's newly formed National Anti-Corruption Bureau show $12.7 million of cash payments that were slated to go to Manafort. It is not known whether Manafort actually received the money. He spent years consulting for former President Viktor Yanukovych. In the early 80s, Manafort also did political consulting work for former Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. The Olympics are continuing in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where Stanford swimmer Simone Manuel has made history, becoming the first African-American female swimmer to win an Olympic medal in an individual event. She won the gold. Manuel tied Canadian swimmer Penny Oleksiak in the 100-meter freestyle. Both women won gold medals and set a new Olympic record. After winning, Manuel said, quote, "It means a lot. Especially with what's going on in the world today, some of the issues of police brutality, this win hopefully brings change and hope to some of the issues that are going on. My color just comes with the territory," she said. Manuel's win was only one of a number of historic Olympic events over the last week. Usain Bolt of Jamaica won the 100-meter dash in 9.81 seconds, making him the only person to ever win the 100-meter race three times. He is Jamaican. American swimmer Michael Phelps scored his 23rd gold medal when the U.S. won the men's 4x100-meter medley relay. Phelps is now the most decorated Olympian in all of history. African-American gymnast Simone Biles scored her third gold medal when she became the first American woman to win the Olympic vault individual. And tennis player Monica Puig won Puerto Rico's first gold medal in Olympic history. She's the first person representing Puerto Rico to ever win an Olympic medal. This is Puig speaking after her victory.
It is a huge achievement for my career. It was the biggest goal I had for my life, and it is something historic for Puerto Rico that had never happened in Puerto Rico's history.
We'll have more on the Olympics later in the broadcast. We'll be going to Rio. Meanwhile, the U.S. declared a public health emergency in Puerto Rico Friday after the island reported nearly 2,000 new cases of Zika over the last week. More than 10,000 cases of Zika infection have been reported in Puerto Rico since December. In New York City, police say they've arrested a suspect in the killing of a revered imam and his friend in Queens on Saturday. Mosque leader Mulama Akanji and friend Thara Uddin were walking home from prayers at the Al-Furqan Jame Mosque just before 2 p.m. when a man approached them from behind and shot them each in the back of the head at point-blank range. Akanji was a father of three from Bangladesh. On Saturday, hundreds protested the killings. This is Ziad Ramadan, the president of the Council on American-Islamic Relations of New York.
CARE New York views this as an assassination. Someone attacked, someone came from behind two imams of a masjid and shot them in the head, both of them. They both passed away this afternoon, one DOA and one fought for his life unsuccessfully, unfortunately. And this wasn't only, our heart goes out to their families and our heart goes out to the community.
Meanwhile, in Chicago, a Muslim mother and daughter reported being spit on and yelled at as they were walking to their car Thursday wearing hijabs. They say the harasser yelled repeatedly, quote, "You're ISIS," unquote. Saham Zadin blamed the attack on Donald Trump, saying her message to Trump was, quote, "to leave the Muslim people in America alone. Leave us alone," she said. In international news, U.S.-backed Saudi-led airstrikes killed at least 19 people in Yemen Saturday after the bombs struck a residential area and a school. Witnesses say the majority of the victims were children. This is one of the fathers of one of the children killed.
This is a crime. My son is dead. He is now with God. We will now head to the front lines and take revenge for our sons.
This comes less than a week after the U.S. approved a possible $1 billion weapons deal to Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, in Syria, activists say hundreds of civilians have been killed in fighting across the country in recent days. The local coordination committees say nearly 200 civilians have been killed since Friday alone. The majority of deaths have occurred in and around the city of Aleppo. Back in the United States, in Louisiana, at least five people have died and 20,000 people have been rescued amidst unprecedented flooding. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards declared a state of emergency over the weekend, calling the flooding historic. Water levels are expected to continue rising. Meanwhile, in Northern California, more than 1,000 people were forced to flee a fast-moving wildfire in the town of Lower Lake over the weekend. Authorities say California's fire season has been worsened by the historic climate-fueled drought. And in Columbus, Ohio, police are investigating the death of 28-year-old Raylan Thomas, a Black transgender woman who was fatally shot by her mother's ex-boyfriend. Family members say the shooter, James Allen Byrd, frequently made transphobic comments to Raylan and sometimes called her the devil. Human Rights Watch says at least 17 transgender people have been killed so far this year in the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests are continuing in Milwaukee 2 days after police shot dead a 23-year-old African-American man named Sylville Smith. On Sunday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker activated the National Guard after local residents set fire to police cars and several local businesses, including a gas station, Saturday night. 17 people were arrested, 4 police officers reportedly injured. Last night, 2 police were reportedly injured, and 1 person was hospitalized after being shot by an unknown assailant. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett spoke out on Sunday.
Last night was unlike anything I have seen in my adult life in this city. I hope I never see it again. For every member of this police department, it was unlike anything that they had seen in their career. For every member of the fire department, it was unlike anything they had seen in their entire career.
The Milwaukee Police Department is defending its use of force in the case of Sylville Smith. Police say he was shot while trying to flee from an officer who'd stopped his car. Police Chief Edward Flynn said he had viewed video from the officer's body camera that hasn't been released. It showed Smith had turned toward him with a gun in his hand after the traffic stop, he said. Many local residents said the tension between their community and the police has been rising for years. Milwaukee's considered to be one of the most segregated cities in the country. country. On Saturday, a man identifying himself as the brother of Sylville Smith spoke to the local Milwaukee station, CBS 58.
Right now, you got a city riot going on because, once again, the police has failed to protect us like they say they was going to do. They failed to be here for the people like they say they like they sworn in to do, you know. And us as a community, we're not going to protect ourselves. But if we don't have anyone to protect us, then this is what you get. You know, you get riots. You got people out here going crazy. We losing loved ones every day to the people that sworn in to protect us. It's other stuff that's going on out here, and you wonder why. It's ISIS in America.
Sedan, certainly people upset here tonight, but we've got, you know, innocent business owners who are now going up in flames. What's it going to take for you guys to be okay tonight and to stop this chaos?
It ain't me. It's not me. I'm going to let y'all know that now. It's not us guys neither. And I'm glad that y'all said that. It's not us. It's the police. This the madness that they spark up. This is what they encourage. This is what they provoke. This is what you get out of you taking some a loved one from someone. This is what you get. You get a lot of people that's hurt, and they can't vent the right way. They can't no longer depend on the police to be here to protect us like they say they're going to do. So this is what you get. And no, it's not going to end today. I can't tell you it's going to end tomorrow. I don't know when it's going to end. But it's for y'all to start. We're not the ones that's killing us. Y'all killing us. We can't make a change if y'all don't change.
That was Sedan Smith speaking to CBS 58. Smith said he's the brother of Sylville Smith, the 23-year-old man killed by Milwaukee police on Saturday. For more, we go to Milwaukee, where we're joined by Muhib Dyer. He's a community activist, a poet, co-founder of the organization Flood the Hood with Dreams. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Muhib. Can you talk us through the weekend, what happened Saturday night, and about the community response?
How are you doing, Ms. Goodman? And it's a pleasure to be on Democracy Now! Today. Well, I mean, as you can see, you know, on the surface level, and I had the opportunity to be out there last night, you see what appears to be complete chaos. Gas stations are being burned. You see individuals riding around, hanging out of cars. In some cases, gunshots everywhere. You see the police, in some cases, taking very provocative stances, provoking certain incidences amongst peaceful demonstrators at times. And then on the other hand, you see anger, anger and the frustration of a community that has suffered atrocities and oppression on behalf of what they deem to be the police oppressive system that has never seemingly been held accountable for taking the life of, like the young man said, of their loved one. So when you put that all together, it becomes a powder keg. And it's the explosion, metaphorically, that you get that's going on in Milwaukee today.
So talk about what you understand took place on Saturday night with the police killing of Sylville Smith.
What I understand now, I mean, is various vantage points, of course, various stories. But what the police are saying, what you reported, is that a young man was stopped in a routine traffic stop, I suppose, and he fled an officer, and what he fled from an officer, and what happened was at some point he turned his pistol towards the officer, and the officers say that they justifiably shot him. Was the reports that's coming out of the community is that it's the exact opposite. Some are saying the young man was unarmed and he had no gun on him at all. Some are saying that the young man had a gun and he was hopping over a fence. And as he hopped over a fence, the gun fell and he picked up the gun to throw it over the fence and the officer shot him in the back. So to put it in a nutshell, we don't know. We're going to have to wait for the videotape to be released. So everything now is speculation, and it's the police word against the community's word.
Why haven't the police released the video cam of the officer and the officers who were involved in his killing?
I don't know, ma'am. They say this is their procedure, that it takes time for them to be able to sort through things while they're doing their own investigation. The reality of the situation that we're seeing in Milwaukee and all over the United States of America is that the community is very frustrated and very upset in terms of what's going on, because you always have situations where African-American males are being killed, and then you have the police department taking their time releasing their facts. And whether you catch something on videotape, and I guess this is the sentiment of the community, whether it's on videotape or whether it's eyewitnesses, we never get our day in court. We never get our day in court. Police officers are never held accountable for the murders of African-American males. It's always justifiable homicide. They release these reports talking about the character of an individual, which really, I think, creates the condition for public opinion to say, OK, yes, he deserved it. You know, he had a lengthy police record. He deserved it. He was a thug. He was a criminal. He deserved it. So I think they build public opinion to such an extent where homicide, like I said before, the homicide of police officers on African-American males always seems to be justified. And they never really talk about what happened in that actual event. They don't separate the actual event from the person's character, I guess.
Milwaukee has been described as the most segregated city in America. You grew up there, Muhib. Can you talk about your city?
Yes, I can. I was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And, you know, we lead the nation in many of what they say the most critical statistics in this country. You know, we have the fourth highest rate of poverty amongst all cities in America. One statistical poll said we also are said to have the second highest segregation rate in this country. We have one of the highest incarceration rates amongst African-Americans in this country. The school dropout rate is off the charts. So with all of this going on, and the factories have closed and the economic plight of the city has gone down, growing up in Milwaukee always felt like this was a place of extreme despair. Some good people, very talented individuals who are striving to make a difference, but that's juxtaposed with the reality that accomplishment or prosperity or the sense of upward mobility amongst the people is a very difficult place. And what's going on, I think, being played out in the streets today is that you have these young people who feel the hopelessness and who feel the despair, and they want something different. But like the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, that violence is the language of the unheard. How is violence the language of unheard? The unheard, he said that America is not listening to the yearnings of freedom and justice, the desire of freedom and justice. And what is America not paying attention to? Dr. Martin Luther King said that white people, for the most part, are so preoccupied with tranquility and status quo, that they are missing the point that freedom and justice and equality are not being met out. And this is Milwaukee.
Milwaukee's police department has a long history of distrust with by the black community. Tensions flared in 1991 as Milwaukee police were accused of turning a blind eye as serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer targeted primarily African-American, Latino and Asian boys, who was ultimately convicted of 15 murders in Wisconsin. His story chronicled in the documentary The Jeffrey Dahmer Files. This is Dahmer's former neighbor, Pamela Bass, talking about the outcry.
My sister called my mother. She said, look at TV, Ma. Isn't this Pamela's building in Milwaukee?
Public outcry followed, accusing police of racism and insensitivity to gays.
And she saw all the swarm of people around me, so she knew that she couldn't, I can't get to her. And I remember I finally got through to her on the phone. She told me, don't watch TV, Pamela. Don't read none of this.
As chief, both I and the entire department must accept responsibility for the inadequate
It was just, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about this thing. The city of Milwaukee, to me, just lost. They care nothing about the black community as a whole. They weren't showing it back then.
That was Pamela Bass, the neighbor of Jeffrey Dahmer, speaking in the documentary The Jeffrey Dahmer Files. Muhib Dyer, how does what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer affect the way people see what happens in Milwaukee? And then, of course, in 1981, there was Ernest Lacey, who was put in a police car, taken by police. They were just cruising downtown, the police, and he ends up dead in the back of the police car.
Well, you know, like I said, it just contributes to what we saw Saturday night and last night, Sunday night. You have a history of, like you said, Ernie Lacey, and you have Daniel Bell all the way up to a couple years ago and Dontre Hamilton. You have all of these names of individuals who have been murdered by the police. And to my knowledge, they've never been convicted of or held accountable for their actions. And a fallback argument all across America every time a police officer murders an African-American is, you all kill each other every night. There is black-on-black crime every night. Like, that's the scapegoat argument. But ultimately, when black people kill black people, accountability happens. Black people go to jail. And, you know, the thing is, why are there not more rioting when violence happens in an African-American community? Because black people go to jail. Black people are held accountable. Black people are given sentences of homicide where they have to be held accountable for the actions that they take. But when you have individuals, like the young man said, who are supposed to protect and serve, and they come in and they kill you, and there is never any convictions, then the sentiment is that we can't get justice. We can't get justice.
Can you tell us what your T-shirt says?
My T-shirt says the I Will Not Die Young campaign. And this is an organization. Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
The I Will Not Die Young campaign.
I want to, for you to end, because I know you have to go teach, with your poem. You are not only a community activist, co-founder of the organization Flood the Hood with Dreams, but you are also a poet. Can you share a poem with
us
today?
Yes, ma'am. And this, I hope, gives the listeners an understanding of the feeling of the despair of a young person that exists in Milwaukee. I want you to see beyond the bottles being thrown. I want you to see beyond the anger and see a young man on his hands and knees looking up to the heavens, not knowing if God exists, on a street called Burleigh in Milwaukee. And he says, it's like I'm sitting in a jail cell, Lord, listen to me. It's like I'm sitting in a jail cell, God, listen to me. It's like I'm sitting in a jail cell, Lord, with invisible bars, waiting on death row, counting down the days because I know they coming. You see, I know they coming in police, them jealous dudes and chicks. They all coming, and it wasn't supposed to be like this. You see, Lord, they never told me you were in me. They never told me you were always there. So in turn, I believed what I saw, and what I saw was a daddy that was never around and a mama that was always crying because we were always broke when there was money outside. And rats and roaches and pissy mattresses me and my brother slept on when it was money outside, and teachers that told me I had to wait 12 years to get paid. You see, my teachers told me I had to wait 12 years to get paid while all of them got paid off of me right now, whether I learned or not, when it was money outside, and what else was I supposed to do? They never told me you were in me, God. They never told me you were always there. And how was I supposed to know that being created in your image and your likeness meant that if you made the earth, Lord, I could make my own business. And if you made the sun, I could make more than just babies. More than just babies, but buildings and networks and that. Busting guns, or was it the only way to get access to your power, Lord? And shaking these dudes down on the block for this dope money was not the only way to get access to your power, Lord. How was I supposed to know? And how was I supposed to know that downing shots of Hennessy and smoking weed wasn't the only way to accept this and get to heaven, that I could have got down on all fours and talked to you, Lord? They never told me you were in me. They never told me you were always there. And how was I supposed to know that every time mama was like, stay in school, baby, stay off those streets, that was you, Lord? And every misdemeanor charge you ever beat, that was you, Lord. Every felony charge you ever beat, that was you, Lord. And when those bullets missed me, when I was on the block doing wrong, that was you, Lord. And when my boy laid in that casket, cold and lifeless, that was like you was trying to tell me he would be me if I didn't change. And now I've fallen. My time is up. I know they coming. And I don't even know if you listen to kids like us, Lord. Do you even care about kids like us, Lord? But I know now what I should have known then. And it took me to fall to see the light. You were always in me. You were always there. Forgive me, Lord, for I knew not what I was doing to myself. Please send me somebody, a voice, maybe from across the nation, a sympathetic voice that understands that I need to be taught something that I've never been taught before. Please send me someone, anybody in humanity that can teach me to love me. Teach me to love me. Teach me to love me. Thank you.
Muhib Dyer, I want to thank you for being with us. Community activist, poet, co-founder of the organization Flood the Hood with Dreams, speaking to us from his hometown that went up in flames this weekend after police killed an African-American man on Saturday night, speaking to us from Milwaukee, one of the most segregated cities in the country. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. There are remarkable firsts that have taken place in the last week, and we're going to talk with two guests about them. Stay with us. A black man used to die because the author was lynched. But now he often dies for his golden trench. Two shots are fired off without a blink or a flinch. The statue that you praise is a horrible wench. She lies to you daily, kills you off yearly. In 1995, the Canaanites were paid dearly. So brothers and sisters, beware of who you trust. Because they don't want justice, they want just justice. They want justice. They don't want justice.
Saying stop, but I'm not through yet. My rhymes are blatant like racism, black activism, white supremacy. Step away from me. George Washington owned slaves and flocks. Yet you got the nerve to call the space in rocks. Napoleon broke the nose off the face of the Sphinx. Why do you think he did it? Take a second to think. Yo, a tree without roots is not a tree. A bee without a stinger is not a bee. You raped my grandma. You whipped my grandpa. A century goes by.
The Cali Tribe. Just us here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we head to Brazil. The Olympics are continuing in Rio de Janeiro, where Stanford swimmer Simone Manuel has made history, becoming the first African-American female swimmer to win an Olympic medal in an individual event. Manuel tied Canadian swimmer Penny Oleksiak in the 100-meter freestyle. Both women won gold medals and set a new Olympic record. After winning, Simone Manuel said, quote, "It means a lot, especially with what's going on in the world today. Some of the issues of police brutality, this win hopefully brings hope and change to some of the issues that are going on. My color just comes with the territory," she said. Simone Manuel's win was only one of a number of historic Olympic events over the last week. Usain Bolt of Jamaica won the 100-meter dash in 9.81 seconds Sunday night, making him the only person to ever win the 100-meter race three times. He was Jamaican. American swimmer Michael Phelps scored his 23rd gold medal when the U.S. won the men's 4x100-meter medley relay. Phelps is now the most decorated Olympian in all history. African-American gymnast Simone Biles scored her third gold medal when she became the first American woman to win the Olympic vault individual. And tennis player Monica Puig won Puerto Rico's first gold medal in Olympic history. Joining us now is Jesse Washington, senior writer for The Undefeated, covering the Olympics from Rio. Jesse, thanks so much for being with us. Talk about these significant wins, Jesse. Why don't you begin with Simone Biles?
Well, Simone is the greatest gymnast of all time by popular claim, by the testimony of the gymnasts who have come before her. And there's a lot of pride in the black community about that. To see a young black woman excelling on the world stage, it has a lot of significance for a community that still can feel marginalized and forgotten and not appreciated.
And she has an amazing life story, Simone Biles, who was born in Columbus, Ohio, is that right? And with her connection, both her family being raised by her grandparents and her connection to Belize, which is also celebrating.
She does have an amazing story, and she's had to overcome a lot of adversity, and she has a tough relationship with her mom, even to this day. And so that creates more of an underdog spirit. And I think it also kind of plays into some of these stereotypes that a lot of the media likes to see about young black athletes growing up in these troubled areas, drugs, parents, that kind of thing. And so that's made her story more attractive for a narrative. But at the same time, she had a set of grandparents that took her in that were prosperous. Her grandparents were able to build a million-dollar gym for her to train in. So that's not something you think about often when you see a young black athlete. Mm.
Right. Her mother had drug problems. Her kid and her four children, Simone being one of them, she was losing them. And her grandparents took her and her sibling to her and her sibling in. And then raise them. And the country of Belize?
You know, I don't know much about the country of Belize with her. I'm not up on that aspect
Belize.
Of her story.
Yeah, her grandmother, who raised her as her mother, was from Belize. But talk overall about the significance of the Rio Olympics with the kind of historic wins you've been covering.
Well, I work for The Undefeated, which is a website about race and sports. And so we're very attuned to a lot of the racial dynamics that are going down here. Our audience is very interested in firsts and in successful black athletes, athletes of color, black women who overcome odds to do great things. And there's been a number of moments like that here in these Rio Olympics, Simone Manuel being one of the best examples as the first black swimmer to win an individual gold medal. Now, when you start getting into these firsts, sometimes it's the first black woman to win an individual, the first black woman to win a relay, first left-handed black swimmer to win a medal on a Tuesday. So it shows that there's still a hunger for these firsts to be recognized. But overlooked in the whole Simone Manuel, indeed a historic accomplishment, is that Simone and her teammate, Leah Neal, who have both been being asked all these black swimmer questions, they're ready to just be swimmers. And I asked Leah when I had a chance to sit down with her, how do you feel about always getting asked leading into these Olympics, black swimmer, black swimmer, black swimmer? And she said, it can be tough. And Simone Manuel told me it weighs me down a little bit. And when I got in the pool to win that gold, I had to get rid of the weight of the whole black community. So it's interesting how these narratives can really form. And we think that we're praising and celebrating these athletes, but it can be tough for them. Nevertheless, it has been a big deal here in Rio, and a black woman won the first U.S. medal in the shot put ever, first gold medal ever. The Shot Diva. If you haven't been on the Shot Diva's Instagram, you got to go there, get yourself some clothes, some makeup. She's really cool. So there's been a lot of moments like that here in Rio, and it's been pretty awesome to see.
I want to turn to Simone Manuel. Well, the first African-American woman to win an individual swimming gold medal, asked about the significance of her victory immediately after the race. She was speaking to NBC.
You are the first African-American woman to medal in an individual event in swimming. What does that mean to you, Simone?
Yeah, it means a lot. I mean, this medal is not just for me. It's for a whole bunch of people who have came before me and have been inspiration to me, Maritza, Colin, and it's for all the people after me who can't, who believe they can't do it, and I just want to be inspiration to others that you can do it.
After Simone Manuel was awarded the gold medal, she said, quote, it means a lot, especially with what's going on in the world today, some of the issues of police brutality. This win hopefully brings hope and change to some of the issues that are going on. My color just comes with the territory, she said. She also said, just coming into this race, I kind of tried to take the weight of the black community off my shoulders, which is something I carry with me. Just being in this position, I want to be an inspiration, but I'd like there to be a day when it's not Simone, the black swimmer, as you said, Jesse Washington.
Yes, she did say she would like it to be not Simone, the black swimmer. And that's because I asked her, are you ready to move past this? Haven't we got enough firsts now to just say, all right, we can be finished with the race question in swimming? We've had a gold medal in the year 2000. We've had golds and world records and all types of swimmers. And she's ready to do that. And she also said, calling me the first black swimmer makes it seem like I can't swim fast, that I can't break records. It almost has this sort of affirmative action type feel to it. So I think that one of the reasons why this narrative developed is I was at the press conference with Simone after her historic win, and there were at least 100 journalists there from around the world. There were 50, 60 cameras. And I looked around the room, and I was the only black journalist in the room. And I checked every face and behind every camera. And to me, that really said something. So everyone is fixated on this first thing because that's, in their minds, justifiably so. They feel like I'm praising you, I'm giving you your props, I'm recognizing this historic thing. But you have to look deeper than that sometimes. And you have to look at how these athletes feel, the weight that they carry with them. I'm wearing a shirt right now. I don't know if you could see it from the 68 Olympics, one of the most famous Olympic moments, where the 200-meter medalist gave the Black Power salute on the medal stand. They were kicked out of the Olympics. Their careers were over because they took a moment to say, listen, black folks need their rights to be respected in the United States. So the fact that we're still dealing with this all these years later and that we're still looking for first in the Olympics, we're still looking to black athletes as the spokesmen for black America and the spokeswomen for black America instead of athletes, I think it's time to change the narrative.
Well, after Simone Manuel's historic win, her mother, Sharon Emanuel, spoke about Simone's role in the sport of swimming.
When she was about 11 years old, she did come to me one day. We were just home having casual conversations. And she asked me a question about why she didn't see many others like herself in the sport of swimming. And I didn't have an answer for it immediately. And I said, that's a good question. I don't know. So let's look it up. And so we got on the internet and we looked up information and we kind of just pulled different articles and started reading. And I think for her, that was the moment that she realized that she had a bigger role to play in what she was doing in the sport of swimming.
So that is the mother of Simone Manuel. You mentioned the shot put gold. Michelle Carter, what is her story?
Michelle Carter, the shot diva. She is the daughter of a Super Bowl winner and a shot put gold medalist, Michael Carter. Her dad played nose tackle and run three rings with the 49ers. She is interesting because she says, hey, I'm in a sport here. I asked her a question at the news conference, and she responded by saying, a lot of people don't even look at us as women, which is a tough thing to say. We're big, we're athletes, we're out here getting sweaty. So she maintains her beauty at all times. She, after she won the gold medal, it appeared briefly that she was crying. She was actually reapplying her lipstick, and she embraces her femininity. She also embraces her size. On the official U.S. Olympic website, she's listed as 5'9", 210. That is not the dimensions of a woman who mainstream America would consider beautiful. However, she is a beautiful woman. She embraces that, and she helps other women of all sizes and colors say, hey, be happy with who you are. Do you, and you will do better. So I think that that's an important thing for women, and particularly for black women who have been hit with a lot of body image issues over the years. It was really inspiring to see her win gold on her final attempt when she defeated what someone called the Michael Phelps of the shot put, who happens to be Steven Adams from the Oklahoma City Thunder's big sister. And when I say big sister, this woman was definitely a big sister.
I want to turn to Michelle Carter.
Michelle Carter took her out and won the gold on her final attempt.
I want to turn to Michelle Carter, the first American woman to win a shot put medal at the Olympics in 56 years, coached by her dad, as you said, who won a silver in the 1984 Games in Los Angeles. They're the first father-daughter to win medals in the same Olympic event. This is Michelle speaking Sunday.
We already have a place in history. I'm just kind of adding to what's already there. And so I think having that kind of mindset takes that pressure off, because I'm not really trying to make my own story. I'm already adding to a story that's already there. I'm like, I'm starting a new chapter or the next book or something like that. So I can't say, I definitely can't take away anything that he's done, because it's helped groom me to the athlete I am today.
So there you have the shot put winner, Michelle Carter, speaking after the Olympics. We're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to, in addition to being joined by Jesse Washington, senior writer for The Undefeated, we're going to be joined by Anthony Irvin, who is the oldest swimming champ in Olympic history. Stay with us.
Eu sei o que eu quero pra vida, pois nada me faz, irmão. Sem o suor, o valor da conquista permanece em vão. Sempre é hora pra fazer algo melhor acontecer. E a sua hora vai chegar. Agora é pra valer.
Um mundo novo só de gente boa. Esse é o meu lugar. Não nasci ontem, não. Sigo nessa missão. E assim eu vou chegar. Fazer acontecer, lutar e conquistar. Mantenho a fé pra caminhar. E assim eu vou. De alma e coração.
A vida não é brincadeira, não marco bobeira, eu cheguei pra ficar. Acredito que tudo tem hora, tem o seu momento e tem o seu lugar. Pois errar faz parte, evoluir é arte, basta acreditar, depende de você.
Um mundo novo só de gente boa, esse é o meu lugar.
Alma e Coração, that's Soul and Heart by Chiguinho and Projota, the official music of the Rio Olympics. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Rio de Janeiro. At least that's where our guests are. We're joined by Jesse Washington of The Undefeated, as well as Anthony Irvin, U.S. swimming champion and four-time Olympic medalist. At 35 years old, he's the oldest ever individual Olympic swimming gold medalist. Just wrote the book, Chasing Water, Elegy of an Olympian. Anthony, welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your remarkable victory. Talk about how you feel right now and what it means to you.
Well, thank you for having me. I feel good. I've got some lights burning right into me, and I'm staring into a vacuum to talk back to you.
Well, talk about how you felt when you realized. When did you realize you had won with all those toddlers in the pool, you at 35?
Oh, they're hardly toddlers. That was a very competitive field of athletes that I've raced frequently over the last 4 years. But I knew right away. Right away, I turned around, looked right up at the scoreboard, saw the one next to my name, And immediately there was this sense of almost ridiculousness and surrealness that I was Olympic champion again. And I smiled and kind of laughed for a moment. And then I knew that my brother and my friends who came down were up in the stands. So I hopped up on a lane line and yelled to them as loud as I could.
You're being called the Usain Bolt of swimming, or maybe he'll be called the Anthony Irvin of track. But you have come to this with through a very unusual journey. You gave this all up after the Olympics in Sydney when you also won, right? You won gold and then auctioned off your medal to help the people of the tsunami in Thailand who suffered.
Yeah, the Indian Ocean tsunami. That's right. Yeah, that was a long time ago, and I feel like I've come so far, traveled quite a ways to arrive back at this point, but the view is quite a bit different than it was 16 years ago.
So that was in the year 2000. Why did you give it up then? And talk about your journey, your conversion. You became a Buddhist. Talk about your life in these 16 years.
Oh, man, that takes a while, you know. Wrote a whole book about it, and even that seemed like it was cut short. Where to begin? Let's see. I stopped because the reason I was into it, the reason why I swim is because I enjoy it. And, you know, I enjoy the competitiveness of it, and I had that Olympic dream. And after having achieved the Olympic dream and winning my gold medal, you know, for me, that was it. That was all I really had considered. And that the idea that I could be standing here right now talking to whoever may be listening about it, that wasn't in the cards initially. That wasn't part of my dream. But that was the reality. And I did not want to deal with it. I didn't know how to deal with it. I was scared to deal with it. I didn't feel like I had the education to really support coming on here and trying to give in such a manner. So having accomplished my goals in the pool, I wanted to go and try to reach out to some other goals that I had sacrificed along the way. So I went and did a bunch of other things. Yes, I discovered Buddhism at one point. I was still swimming then. I was trying to find some kind of balance, and I found the practice of meditation to be quite fulfilling for me. And ethically and morally educational. And but, you know, things changed. It was a long route, a lot of ups and downs. I don't want to get too much into them. But when I, you know, I was invited to New York to teach kids to swim. And it was there that I rediscovered my love for the water. I think over the course of the time and the competition, that sense of play that I saw in the kids, you know, initially they were very afraid of the water, and for good reason, because it can be dangerous, and that's why we learn to swim. That's why it's important that everybody learns to swim. It's a life-saving skill. But once they have overcome that, once they start getting that, then you see them play. They start going under the water. They don't really listen to you anymore. It becomes a challenge to teach because they're just immersed in the element, and they're free and suspended in it, and they can do and be whatever they want in those moments. And that was what I initially loved about it, and I'd lost that. But after rediscovering it through them, you know, I knew that there was more for me to do. I wanted more for myself. And so I went back to school, finished my degree, and shortly thereafter, you know, after starting graduate school, actually, you know, I smoked my last cigarette, and then I went swimming and have been in and out of the pool since.
Anthony, you write in your beautiful book, Chasing Water, Elegy of an Olympian, about what it was like after you won in 2000, you won that gold medal, about being promoted as an African-American trailblazer, when you felt at that point as a teen you hadn't really grown up with that Black identity. Can you talk about your life in that way, who your parents are?
Sure. You know, my mom, she came from New York City. She's a city gal. You know, she even keeps around her personal history is a mystery, even to me and the rest of us kids. And my dad came from West Virginia. You know, his father was a coal miner. And, you know, he was I mean, the question of blackness, you know, is a question of authenticity, and to be viewed in that way. And swimming is, it's a very visual sport. It's a body. You know, you're literally a body in the water wearing close to nothing. So that body is on display. And if you're talking about blackness, blackness is a color. You know, it's in the eyes of many, it's a skin tone. You know, but then you dig into the history of it, there's the idea of hypodescent. You know, one drop of blood makes you black. So it's all very complicated, and I didn't know about any of this. I wasn't educated on the history of this, or if I was, I was snoozing through it in classrooms. So I didn't know how to necessarily answer to it, and I had trouble tackling, trying to be argue that, no, I authentically am this, if others say I'm not, or people trying to posit some kind of identity on me, which I did not drape on myself. It's a question of being able to pursue my personal freedom and needing to shuck all forms of identity in order to do that.
Your father is African American, Native American?
Not Native American. That was debunked. He believes it, and all of his a bunch of his family believe it. But then when one of my sisters researched it, apparently it's not true. I think that's kind of common.
Well,
but I read it all the time, and it's like, it's not true. If it's Native American, it's just because there's a history dating back to slave days and fighting in the Civil War and the Revolutionary War in my family.
I wanted to bring Jesse Washington back into the conversation, but go to a clip of Ibtihaj Muhammad, who is an African-American Muslim woman who became the first U.S. athlete to compete at the Olympic Games wearing a hijab. She won a bronze medal Saturday in the women's team saber fencing.
I remember being a kid and being told that there were things I couldn't do, you know, whether that be because I was a girl or because I was African American or because I was Muslim. So to be able to stand on top of that podium and represent our country and to show, you know, girls out there, to show our youth out there that they can accomplish anything.
That's Ibtihaj Muhammad, an African-American Muslim woman. Yes, competed in the Olympics in her hijab. Jesse Washington, can you talk about her?
Yes. I was really touched by this, by one simple sight with this American woman. She's out there competing for her country, and on the back of her fencing outfit is her name in big letters, Muhammad, and right under that, USA. And to me, that was really profound, especially in this moment nationally where we're debating even letting Muslims into the country. Here is a woman who has the most Muslim name of all, and it says Muhammad, USA. And she's winning medals for America. So to me, that's definitive proof that Muslims are a part of our nation. They're part of this tapestry, just like all the other religions. And America was a nation founded on the principle of freedom and religious freedom. So she wore the hijab. She also wore the name. And she excelled and won a medal. And so to me, I was very touched. And I think that that's a powerful lesson that a lot of people should pay attention to.
Anthony, we're going to have to go, and we're going to continue the conversation after. But very quickly, Monica Puig won Puerto Rico's first Olympic gold medal. She chose to play for Puerto Rico. She had the choice of the U.S. or Puerto Rico. The significance of this.
Yeah, I have a lot of Boricua friends from New York City, and they're Puerto Rican. And I know they're citizens and everything, but they really rep for their island, their culture, their country. A lot of Puerto Ricans feel that they should be independent from the United States. So that's a huge moment. Viva Boricua. That's what more can I say?
Well, we're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue the conversation with Jesse Washington, senior writer for The Undefeated, and Anthony Irvin. His new book is called Chasing Water, Elegy of an Olympian, the oldest swimmer to win in this year's Rio Olympics. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.